Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Civility seems like a forgotten notion these days in and out of the legislative chambers across the country. Remember this?
If you're looking for a handout, you're in the wrong end of town. Nothing for free over here. You have to work for everything you get.
No, I'll pay for this guy. Here you go. Start a pot. I'll pay for you. No, I'll decide when to give you money.
That occurred last March at a Columbus demonstration against the health care reform moving through Congress. The video came to symbolize what many felt is a breakdown in American political discourse, but there are a lot of other examples. So what is the value of civility? Have we ever enjoyed a real period of so-called civility, and can we achieve it now? Later on the program, Juan Williams, journalist, Fox News commentator, and former NPR commentator, will join us to talk about the relationship between free speech and civility in public discourse. Right now, we welcome OSU professor Emeritus Herb Asher. Herb teaches political science and is a longtime observer of the political process in Ohio and across the nation. Welcome to the show, Herb.
Good to be here.
So before Tucson, as I said, there are a lot of other examples before the health care debate and before Tucson when which we mentioned at the top of the hour, when Representative Gabriel Giffords was shot and six others were killed.
Sure.
What's been the turning point, in your opinion, as far as this phenomenon now?
Well, I think it's actually been a continuing and gradual decline in sort of the politeness, the civility of how we talk about politics and other matters. So it hasn't happened overnight. One can attribute it to a variety of specific circumstances. You could start talking about discourse about war, about the 2000 election, about Bill Clinton when the Republicans tried to impeach him. But I think really what you're seeing here is just a continuing degradation of the quality of our civil discourse. And that's unfortunate because it really means that you start focusing on what I would call sort of peripheral kinds of things. Was the president born in the United States? I mean, the birthers, I mean, that's such a distraction. On the health care, all of a sudden the accusations about death panels and things like that. And so you miss some of the real core issues. But I think beyond that, too, if one of the reasons to keep discourse civil is that, Ann, if you and I are having a disagreement and it's at a policy level and we're disagreeing on a particular issue, but we're treating each other with respect, then that probably means that on future issues we could probably work together. We could probably actually even have a friendship. But if, in fact, in talking about an issue, I'm just attacking your character, your motivation, then, in fact, it's going to be very, very difficult for you and I to work together. And so one of the things I get worried about today is that oftentimes the language that we use in political discourse treats our fellow Americans as if they're the enemy. And I find that to be offensive. They might be our opponents. We might disagree on certain things. But when you start treating your fellow citizen as the enemy, then all of a sudden, once they're the enemy, then anything goes. You can say anything. Any kinds of tactics can go. So I am worried about what this really means for our ability as a community or as a nation to get together and work on common problems. Today we're having interesting battles in Indiana, Wisconsin, and Ohio on collective bargaining. And I think the discussion on collective bargaining, there's sharp disagreements. Mm-hmm. I think it's a more civil discussion in Ohio, even though there's a lot of intensity and passion, than it is in Wisconsin. I have a sense at times that the Wisconsin governor is actually he wants to fuel the fires more. And maybe he'll win on the issue, but at what cost to, in a sense, the ability of that state to come together and work for a common purpose?
On other issues, my guest is OSU Professor Emeritus Herb Asher. We're talking about civil discourse in our society today. What has happened to it? How has it been degraded over time? If you have a question or comment, you're welcome to join the show, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, one thing, back when I covered the legislature, low those many years ago, they used to argue on the floor and debate and disagree with each other on the floor or in committee hearings. But you knew back then that afterwards they all met at a bar somewhere and talked to each other.
Yeah.
Is that – it feels like that's missing now.
Well, I think some of that is missing, and one of the reasons why it's missing is that you're in an era of term limits, particularly at the state level. So if, in fact, you really have colleagues who you don't know, You don't know their families. You don't know where they come from. You don't know their background or whatever. And all you ever do is perhaps disagree on the floor of the House or the Senate. That probably means that it's going to be a little bit, going to be more difficult to really have a good relationship after the fact. I think one of the challenges for us is how do you, in fact, maintain some level of collegiality even as there are passionate disagreements? Because when I talk about civil discourse, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have passionate disagreements. We are going to have those. But how do you have those disagreements? The old cliche is, how do you disagree without being disagreeable? You know, we used to chuckle in the United States Congress when there was debate, and people would say, and they still say it to some extent, but not as much, I beg to differ with the learned gentlewoman from New York.
Right.
And they used to refer to Bella Abzug, who was one of the most feisty, obnoxious members, and people would sort of chuckle because she wasn't the distinguished or gentlewoman. But there was a purpose for using by saying that, and that meant you kept the disagreements at a policy level, not at a personal level. So I think what you saw after the shootings in Tucson was, in fact, the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, saying, no, we do want to get back to certain kinds of norms of courtesy, even though we know we're going to have sharp disagreements. And in the current Congress, especially in the House, we are going to have sharp disagreements. The Republicans, you know, won the House, and they won with a lot of new conservative Tea Party members. So, in fact, the Republican Party of today is far more conservative than the Republican Party of 20 years ago. And the Democrats are more liberal today. And so if you have one party very conservative, another one more liberal, of course they're going to disagree. And nobody should be unhappy about the fact that they disagree and that they're passionate about their disagreements. But they should not treat each other like enemies. They should not question the motivations. They should not question the patriotism. They should actually say here that we, in fact, need to have these kinds of discussions, debates, and no matter how intense they are. But you're right, particularly at the state level. You know, I've heard many members say that, well, you know, I don't even know my colleagues. You know, we cycle in and out, and there really is something to be said that in building personal relationships, getting to know people, getting to know their families, getting to know their history, that that'll make it easier for you to work with them on an issue, even when you've disagreed passionately on a previous issue.
You know, and at the federal level, a lot of them are priding themselves on not moving to the Washington, D.C. area, that they're spending more of their time back in their district, hearing what their district constituents have to say, which, you know, of course, is an issue. But, you know, they're bunking in their offices and that kind of thing, and they're not really getting into the society.
That's right. That's right. And I think that, you know, and I think they're making the argument, oh, if I got to Washington, I would be corrupted or co-opted by that society. But it probably – there probably is a real benefit to getting to know what motivates your opponents. To get a sense here that, you know, life oftentimes isn't black or white. And we'll see whether, in fact, there's any evolution in that direction. You know, you were asking me for, you know, what's been happening. I think also that if you were to look at, let's say, the media environment, and particularly looking, and again, this is now going back, you know, to the good old days when you only had three or four networks. And now
and one of them didn't come in for most of us.
Exactly. Right. And now it's, you know, so many, and it's 24/7 or whatever. And what you get a sense of here is the instantaneous nature of communication. So a comment is made and immediately is disseminated, and before you know it, everybody has a certain opinion. And then later on, the truth never really fully catches up. Or what you see now is, and this was always the case, but even more so today, you know, take the town hall meetings that we're talking about. Now, not the one in particular here in Columbus that you mentioned at the beginning, but now, a lot of the town hall meetings that we had on health care that members of Congress had, you would have thought that, in fact, the entire meeting was just a constant expression of uncivil discourse, when, in fact, it turned out that for many stations throughout the country, the part of the town hall meeting they showed was the most angry part of it, the person who screamed at their member of Congress or whatever. And it turned out most of the meeting was actually reasonably civil. There were differences, there were disagreements. So I think we also tend now to reinforce this kind of behavior.
Because their media is always going to report man bites dog,
exactly.
Not dog bites man.
Yeah, yeah.
However, including the context that this only took up about 10 minutes of an hour and a half long meeting or however, and putting it in context might be helpful.
That would be very helpful.
And contrasting it with other parts of the meeting and stuff. But it would be kind of boring, I guess, is the point.
Even though it would be a more representative presentation of what actually
but
happened.
But that pressure, that 24/7 news cycle,
right.
It's a show. It's a show now. Mike from Northeast Columbus, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. I don't know. I just think it's kind of ridiculous that we're now all of a sudden having this conversation. I mean, it just seems like when the left is inconvenienced and is kind of thrown under the bus with their policies and stuff they're trying to put onto the general public of this country, then and people are speaking out against it, it's civil discourse and it's, you know, angry, and we have to come up with all these names about, you know, how, you know, we're foaming at the mouth and everybody's all, you know.
So you don't think
angry.
It's as bad as it is as it people
no,
are
I
worried
mean, you
about
know,
it being?
I just, you know, I'm looking at over the last, you know, 10 years. I mean, we've had, you know, I'm driving around town and every other bumper sticker I see is a W with a slash through it. You know, we've had, you know, Michael Moore. We've had all of these Hollywood actors speaking out against George Bush and the Republicans. We've had a Broadway play about, you know, the assassination of George Bush. And, you know, anytime any of that stuff comes up, it's like, oh, well, deal with it. You know, turn the channel.
Yeah, hang on, Mike, because it does. That is what the impression is that it's always the left complaining that the right's being violent, the right's being uncivil. Well, is that really the case?
No. Actually, you go back to older times, which I think about Lyndon Johnson, Democratic president. Major expansion of the social welfare state, but of course there was also Vietnam. And there are the protests, you know, hey, hey, LBJ.
Spitting it.
But how many kids did you kill today? I mean, just done really nasty, nasty stuff from the left attacking a Democrat in this case. Then you also had various kinds of plays. I think one of them was McBird or whatever, which was so in fact, I mean, these things repeat themselves and the targets change. And so today, whichever party is in power is more likely to be the one that the target of attack or whatever. And but I think the caller, you know, sees it more as it's liberals whining about conservatives, but in fact, or complaining about conservatives. But in fact, it's on both sides. And if you saw, you know, some of, especially if you go to the blogosphere and you go to some of the websites, you will see people on the extreme left and the extreme right. In fact. Engaging in some of the most nasty of discussions. And my point simply is, let's not treat our fellow citizens as our enemies. We can disagree with them. And I think in disagreeing in a more respectful fashion, we actually move forward as a country better.
Mike, thanks for your call.
All right.
Take care. We have to take a break. When we return, Juan Williams will join us, a Fox News commentator. So stay with us. And if you'd like to join that conversation, get in early, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
For some time, Afghanistan's looked to many like an unwinnable war against entrenched insurgents with safe havens in Pakistan and with a corrupt government in Kabul for an ally. But counterinsurgency expert John Nagle sees reasons for hope.
Afghan security forces are going to continue to get better as we simultaneously degrade the Taliban.
I'm Neil Conan. Another look at the long war. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins this afternoon at 2 right here on 89.7 NPR News. Currently 41 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today with temperatures falling throughout the day to about 34 degrees by 5 o'clock this afternoon. Cloudy skies tonight in a low of 24 degrees. Sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 43. And partly cloudy Tuesday night with a low of 31. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. Joining us now is Juan Williams. Juan is the author of several books. He's a Fox News political analyst, and he's scheduled to be the featured speaker at the sold-out 2011 Stanley Muroff Civil Liberties Forum at the John Glenn School of Public Affairs at Ohio State University. Welcome to the show, Juan.
My pleasure, and good to be with you.
You're writing a book right now in part about your well-publicized and controversial firing from NPR last October, but the thesis also will focus on free speech and the growing difficulty in America of speaking out on sensitive topics. How is it growing? Is it in perception or reality?
I think it's a reality, and I think it's very hard to just get people to talk honestly about so many issues. I mean, you know, obviously we're right in the midst of a huge budget fight here in Washington, where I am today, and the difficulty in getting people, President Obama or the Republican leadership, to say this is the real issue here. We have to deal with tremendous spending in terms of Social Security, Medicare. People won't say it, so you get locked into these really trivial arguments about a very minor slice of the entire federal budget, you know, domestic discretionary spending. And it's as if people are just saying, oh, no, we're not going to talk about the big elephant in the room here because, you know what, that's too troublesome. Too many people would scream and holler. So just don't talk about it. Same thing in my mind applies to conversations about race in America, that, you know, people are just, you know, we don't want to have those conversations. Nobody wants to be called a racist. Nobody wants to be said, oh, you just want to talk about race. You could even extend that to arguments about immigration. We don't have an immigration policy, even though we have literally more than 10 million illegal immigrants in the country. We have no way to deal with it. Why? Because nobody feels free to say what they honestly feel. To the contrary, the demagogues carry the day. So on all these issues, and I could keep going, it just seems like, you know, we are frozen, paralyzed for lack of honest and full-blooded discussion.
And no one corner of the universe has controls the demagoguery. It's coming from all sides.
Correct.
You know, speaking of little bitty things that they're arguing about in Congress right now, knowing what you know about public media and your relationship with it, it's become a vociferous argument in Washington about the funding of public media. They say they want to end funding for NPR, but it comes in the form of ending funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. What do you think about all that? And a lot of it came from the firing, the firing of you from NPR.
Yeah, well, I think that really set off a lot of bells. But I think what it did was it allowed people, especially in the midst of the budget fight that I was just talking about, then to say, well, wait a second, if people who bring different points of view, not liberal, orthodox point of view, are going to get tossed, or people who associate with conservatives on Fox News are therefore targeted as somehow not loyal, well, what, you know, why is it that one brand of political speech is funded by the government? Now, I think NPR makes a big effort to try to beat back that stereotype. You know, NPR founded on, you know, in the 70s, and so many college radio stations coming together and all that. And so the idea has been for a long time, it's liberal radio. But I know that people at NPR have tried to make sure that there is balance. But the problem is that then you get people who are locked in. I think that's what I went through with NPR management in Washington, who get locked into one point of view. And I think it then opened the door to people who said, you know what, we don't see, and given in the budget crisis that we're in and the priorities that we have to set, as the Washington Post wrote yesterday in an editorial, it's nice to have it, but is it really a priority at this time, and especially if there's going to be evidence of political favoritism in the content?
The NPR firing, notwithstanding your points, you know, I get it. What do you think about what public media, though, brings to this whole civil discourse issue?
Oh, well, gee, you know, in fact, I think in so many ways, but specifically in terms of local public radio, Ann, that the kind of content that you get on NPR stations is the most civil in terms of people being willing to not interrupt, not shout, not scream, not have to use the kind of soundbite, you know, provocative language that you get on a lot of talk radio in the country. So to my mind, especially, I want to just emphasize this, local news reporting, you know, especially with the demise of so many big papers and in the country, what you get in terms of local public radio, I think, is almost irreplaceable.
In the case of your controversial firing from NPR in October, it's a good example, perhaps, of focusing on half a statement. You said that the point you were trying to make in admitting your feelings and fears of Muslim garb people in airports after 9/11 was to set up the case for not making rash judgment about people of any faith. That other half of your point was lost in the maelstrom.
Well, it wasn't lost to me. And the,
no.
the funny part was that, you know, it wasn't something that I had to amend or retract or
mm-hmm.
say, oh, no, this is what I meant to say. It's what I said at the time. But it was a larger conversation, and as you just said, I revealed my own anxieties about people in Muslim garbs at airport in the aftermath of 9/11 as a way of saying, but that's not a justification for any kind of acts of discrimination, you know, saying people can't fly on planes or something like that, or subjecting them to racial profiling, and it's no justification for acts of violence, as we had seen in New York, where a Muslim cab driver had had his throat slashed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I said. But the single line about being nervous when I see people in Muslim garb was then taken by NPR management as evidence that I had violated journalistic ethics and used as a basis for firing me.
Last week at a town hall meeting in Georgia, someone in the audience asked a GOP rep, Paul Brown as it was, when or who, I guess depending on who's reporting the case, that someone is going to shoot President Obama. And folks laughed, and Representative Brown said he understood such frustration and that hopefully someone else will be elected president in 2012. And I was wondering, what do you think the responsibility is for public officials? Because this sort of thing happened during the health care debate, too, where there was a lot of angry words like that, and the public officials, the elected officials, I should say, were kind of let it pass and said, well, I didn't want to get into it with them.
Well, and what we've seen recently, you know, with all the birther business and, you know, with, you know, all the ideas that, you know, the Republican leadership here in Washington from John Boehner to Mitch McConnell don't need to say that this is ridiculous to say the president wasn't born in the United States or the president is a Muslim, not a Christian, or this latest incident that you just cited, Ann. I just think it's, again, the kind of extreme rhetoric that, well, you know what, it scares me on one level because I, you know, given what happened to Gabriella Giffords, the congresswoman mm-hmm. from Arizona,
mm-hmm.
that was a madman's actions. But to my mind, you don't want to create an atmosphere that would allow people to talk about shooting elected officials who are engaged in a democratic process of legislation that some people may like, some people may not like. But it is not a basis for physical attacks, much less shooting. And obviously, if you shoot something, you are intending to kill it and then kill that person. So I just think this is so rank. But again, it's the, you know, it's not just that it's offensive to the notion of civility, but I just want to emphasize the point, Ann, it acts to absolutely shut down legitimate discourse about difficult issues in public life because public officials feel that if you try to reach a compromise to resolve an issue, you are going to be subjected to claims that you are a traitor to one side or another, that you're a bad person, that you don't have principle. Can you imagine? The very basis of our democracy, the ability to do politics and to achieve compromise, is now held in disregard. It's held as a point of weakness.
In the wake of the shooting in Tucson, six people were killed. Gabriel Giffords was among 13 or 14 wounded. The University of Arizona is establishing the National Institute for Civil Discourse in the Your Fox News colleague, actually, Greta Van Susteren, was the only media person invited to serve on the board of this new institute. Do you think that sort of tack, these institutes and getting together and talking about it at the college level, is going to address the sort of vitriol that you were just talking about?
Well, you got to start somewhere. You know, I'm curious, given your question, what you think, but my sense is that if you can get to the young people and say, you know what, don't get fooled by the success of, you know, the most extreme talk and phraseology that you hear on TV, on the radio, in some publications, don't get sucked into that as the way of American politics. The history of American politics has included some demagoguery, no doubt about it. But by and large, the way the country has continued to succeed and be a beacon to the world is because we work out our political differences in a civil manner. So civility is key to America. And to think about America's ability to, you know, respond to the likes of Nazis and imperialists and fascists, we're the ones who call on logic, rationality, critical thinking as essential to our political life. And so to young people, it's just very important to say to them, yeah, you know what, you believe what you believe, but you have to understand how to succeed, how to get it enacted by use of civil discourse.
I guess those kinds of institutes and that sort of thing, my question about those would be, does it ever really trickle down to the students, to the average student, let alone the person who doesn't go to college, that isn't there in the ivory tower?
Well, I think it starts with leadership, you know, and so the young people who are graduating from college, who have the benefit of that 4 years of nurturing and development, are ones who are going to set the agenda for so many others. So to my mind, these are the folks who you want to influence because they will influence others. And so I do think it has the potential to trickle down. But when you attend meetings of young people, young Democrats, young Republicans, and you see how energetic and fierce they can be in how they treat the opposition, it does give you pause. I mean, it makes you want to say, hey, you know what? The people who are sitting on the other side are not devils. They have their point of view, and maybe you should listen. You could pick up something from them, and you could start to understand how the two of you could be working together, because everybody's on America's team here. Everybody wants the best for their country, right?
My guest is Juan Williams. He's author of several books. He's a Fox News political analyst. He's scheduled to be the featured speaker at the sold-out 2011 Stanley Muroff Civil Liberties Forum at the John Glenn School of Public Affairs at OSU. He's only going to be with us for about seven more minutes, so if you have a question or comment for him, 614-292-8513. We have an email from Kelly for Juan regarding public discourse. It would appear in most cases that the loudest and abrasive voices emanate from the least educated, i.e. those who are socially myopic and otherwise not up to speed on current events. Do you agree?
I'm sure. I think, you know, I think back in terms of the immigration debate and to the people who got involved with the Minutemen movement and who were just angry. And I don't know about their level of education. I think the man who was the founder was highly educated and an Air Force officer and the like. But later he said he found that his movement had been taken over by people he described as vigilantes, and I think he felt that they were, you know, bitter, angry people. I don't know that they were uneducated people, but I think sometimes people get themselves into a corner, and that happens. And in terms of being the least informed, I do agree that if you listen to some of the comments that come from especially, you know, the talk radio host, you just have to think, well, are you aware of the other side? Are you informed of the details of the problem we're dealing with, or are you just content to make outrageous statements to be a provocateur, to stir up the audience and have them, you know, snickering or outraged at your comments because you just want to be the center of attention?
One of the maybe unintended consequences of having access to so much media now, so many channels every day that you can just turn on and watch, is you don't have to listen to something you don't agree with.
Well, I think that's the biggest danger, Ann. You know, to me, people tuning in to things or shows, I should say, not things, but to shows and programs that simply affirm their pre-existing opinions and ideologies is a threat to the country. Because one of the great things about America, you know, the slogan, you know, one out of many, is that we listen to each other, we hear each other, we're aware of bigger problems, not only in our families and communities, our neighborhoods, but in the nation and the world. And once we stop listening, once we simply say, anybody who disagrees with me, anybody who has a different point of view is a bad person, well, I think it means that the fabric of America, the ability for Americans to deal with problems, breaks down.
We have an email from Janet. She writes, my question is whether the current level of uncivility is more pronounced than what it was before Obama was elected.
Well, I think President Bush was subjected to some pretty bitter vitriol around the time of the war in Iraq, questions about, you know, Was it blood for oil, if you will recall? Questions about his intelligence when weapons of mass destruction weren't found. The suspicion that somehow, you know, he was serving the interest of big business or something. So I think that was pretty rank. And then, of course, remember the attacks on John Kerry, what they call the swift voting of John Kerry.
That's right.
A man who had gone overseas, gone to Vietnam to fight for his country. And suddenly he was made out to be an elitist who was not patriotic and who had lied about his record in the military. I mean, this is... So to me, this, you know, a lot of this, and of course, I would identify to the emailer, and I would say, you know, I think a lot of this starts back with the impeachment of Bill Clinton. Remember how harsh the language was about Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky, the president's behavior,
yep,
question. Wow, and that polarized the country intensely. And, of course, then that was followed up by the 2000 election, and then people said that President Bush had stolen the election. The Supreme Court was an illegitimate institution that had acted on a political basis and stole. So that kind of vitriol has been around now for a little bit.
And the whole issue with the stolen election and whatnot is it's getting very close now. It's like the nation split.
It certainly is. You know, the only time that we have come back in this period, let's say, you know, roughly a 10-year period, would be 9/11. After 9/11, you had all the flags flying and everybody was one America. President Bush's ratings reached up to 90% because everybody had a sense that we had a common enemy and that we needed to hang together to survive. But, it didn't last very long.
We have time for just one call and let's see. Tom from Circleville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. I would just like to ask the gentleman there that's with me today what he thinks about Glenn Beck, and I'd like to say the poison that he spews, but, you know, Glenn Beck's view, which I think is really way out there in La La Land. And I'll take my answer off the phone.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
Well, I think Glenn's an entertainer, and, you know, when he says things like Obama is a racist who hates white people, given that Obama's mother is white, I think, what are you talking about? You know, and I've said that to Glenn Beck because he's my colleague at Fox News. But mm-hmm. Glenn says, you know, he's basically, in his own words, you know, the rodeo clown. You know, he distracts people. He's out there saying the most provocative, wild-eyed things. Last week, I guess it was, he was making out the events in Egypt and in now in Libya to be connected to some left-wing conspiracy in the United States. I'm like, what is going on here? But you know what? A lot of people listen to Glenn. He's very popular. But I, again, in terms of serious political dialogue, I just don't see it.
That is all the time we have. Juan Williams, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Juan's going to be in town tomorrow. You can learn more about it from a link at our website, WOSU.org/allsides. He's a Fox News political analyst and a featured speaker at Ohio State University. We'll be right back with more with Herb Asher in just a few minutes.
On the next Fresh Air, an inside look at Libya. Dirk Vandewall joins us. He's a Dartmouth professor who studies and writes about Libya. We'll talk about Gaddafi and his 42-year-long rule. The North African country is in the news after an uprising sparked by the arrest of a human rights lawyer. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon here on 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and we'll hear how to bring our backyards to life with native plants that attract birds, bees, butterflies, and other wild creatures. And also next hour, we'll hear a special report on human sex trafficking in Central Ohio with WOSU News reporter Mandy Trimble. Join us for Hour 2 of All Sides beginning at 11 o'clock. and WOSU Public Media presents the Columbus Metropolitan Club's Wednesday Forum. Wednesday at noon, it's Preparing for a Demographic Tsunami, Part 2, a discussion about creating lifelong communities to accommodate a changing demographic. Tickets and more information available at columbusmetroclub.org. 41 degrees in downtown Columbus with cloudy skies. Temperatures falling this afternoon to about 34 degrees by 5 o'clock. Cloudy skies tonight, a low of 24 degrees. Sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 43. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher, my guest. This segment, we return to Herb Asher. He's OSU Political Science Emeritus, Political Science Professor Emeritus. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And, you know, getting back to something that Juan Williams mentioned, made a reference to this point that Glenn Beck has been making repeatedly now about this article that was written back in the 1960s, kind of a blueprint for revolution, for the socialist revolution or the communist revolution or something around the world. That article is written by Frances Fox Piven. She's a political activist and American professor at City University of New York. And it was her article that made her the target of Glenn Beck and his followers, and obviously she's got a bone to pick with Glenn Beck, you know, that's her business. But in commentary earlier in February, in response to the attack, she said, quote, "When the process of governing is incomprehensible, manipulation and propaganda thrives." In other words, things are just so complicated now that we're dying for somebody to break it down for us, make it simple, and be pithy, if you can, while you're at it.
That's right, and some of those somebodies are the media, who really are the intermediaries between the politicians and what we citizens learn. And I think you're right that oftentimes sound bites, and the sound bites themselves are getting shorter and shorter. You know, I used to be able to have a 25-second sound bite. Now I know if I'm doing an interview with a TV person, if I give them an 8-second sound bite, it'll get used. If it's too long, they probably won't use it. And I'm thinking, what is happening to, in a sense, the quality of our conversation? So I think there really is a challenge. And you know, out there, you mentioned before, Ann, about the 24/7, the news hole that needs to be filled. Clearly, any of us now can, if we say outrageous things, if we say simplistic things, I mean, we now all can get on some kind of television show, certainly online or whatever. There's such a need to fill this news hole or whatever. And I think the kind of screening that is provided in terms of the quality of what gets put on, that screening is much weaker than it used to be. So I find it, when I talk to a reporter, now mainly I'm talking to reporters who are, of course, from very reputable newspapers and television stations and all that. But even I get nervous that if I say something, if I try to give one of my typically long-winded answers like now, and I say, well, some people might argue, but I worry that, in fact, what they will actually use is the first part of my sentence, and it'll take off. Some people might argue, and they'll say, Asher said. And so I wind up saying to them, please quote me in its entirety. But then I realize my quote is way too long, and therefore they're going to excerpt. So I always say, please make sure you excerpt in ways that actually represent what I said. When I heard Juan Williams talking, you know, it is so unfortunate, and this happens multiple times, all the time actually. If you read his entire statement, it turns out it's a very, I'll use actually, fair and balanced statement. And it is so unfortunate and so unfair to him that the media just picked up on the first part of his statement. Reminds me of what happened with the woman at the Department of Agriculture.
Right.
So one of the challenges we all have as consumers of the media is, how do we know what we're getting is actually a fair representation of what a political official said or a reporter said or anybody said or whatever?
And then in both of those cases, no one, it happens, they're misrepresented, and no one takes the time till it's too late.
That's right. I mean, you almost have to do the correction immediately, because if you wait 24 hours, it's gotten out over the blogosphere, and everybody has now weighed in, and all of the noise that's out there actually overshadows the correction that happens or the elaboration that happens later.
Gosh, when I think of the balloon boy, I think it's a matter of minutes sometimes. Terry from Youngstown, you're on the air. Thank you for waiting so long.
Oh, you're quite welcome. No problem. My question or comment is, in the state of Ohio, we do want to have civil discourse, but, you know, how can you when you have a governor that tells the people in Ohio on the night of his victorious election that you don't agree, you'd rather get on the bus or we run you over? And I sat on the 3C corridor for the Youngstown area for 2.5 years talking about it.
About high-speed rail in Ohio, which is done.
Right.
Yeah.
And he never came back and talked to any of the panels throughout the Ohio saying, what kind of compromise or what can we do? You know what I mean? He just threw the money back to Washington, and now he wants that money back to do the Cleveland area. And, you know, it's like, buddy, you know, how can you have civil discourse when you don't talk to the people that were part of the discussion, you know, 2.5 years ago or other stuff, and like even the state employees? This fight should have never brought to the this fight should have never been to the streets, man. It should have been brought to the back room with the union representatives talking about, okay, what can we do to balance the budget?
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. I mean, even State Senator Bill Seitz, her Republican, said that, gosh, you know, if we did it the old way, we probably could have gotten a lot more done by this point. Yeah. Thank you, Terry, for your call.
Yeah, what we've just done, though, is we've done just on a segue from rail to collective bargaining, because I think that's what that last reference is, to collective bargaining. And again, obviously, this is a very passionate issue with very intense feelings on the part of labor unions, on the part of many Republicans, on the part of some local officials. And clearly, what I do think that at least the discussion here in Ohio on that has actually been more civil than it has been in Wisconsin. And I thought it was very interesting that just the other day, the governor actually was trying to make a distinction here. He said, I'm not anti-union. Now, people may disagree with him about that, but here he is trying to say, I'm not anti-union, but this is an issue for local governments and their ability to pay for public services and all of that. And I thought that kind of rhetoric is perfectly appropriate, and I thought it was meant to be sort of a calming rhetoric. I know the caller said that, the governor after his election had said, you know, if you don't get on the bus, we'll run you over.
Well, do you think he's learned a thing or two? Because he did say things like that.
And he said that, actually, he said that to a group of lobbyists, so
right.
not that you should say that to lobbyists.
But it was reported.
Oh, absolutely.
In the
press. No, absolutely. No, and look, and yeah. And I think one of the things one learns is that when you're the governor, anything you say really becomes the topic or the target of focus of media attention. So there probably needs to be more careful. And again, I think in his comments throughout this discussion about pension reform and about collective bargaining have been, I think, more temperate. But again, these are issues that sharply divide people. They have very different – the different sides have very different views about the role of government, about the role of labor unions. So, in fact, it's going to be a very, very tense issue.
James in Clintonville, welcome to the show.
Yeah, I heard Dr. Asher earlier talking about the Republican Party has moved to the right and the Democratic Party has moved to the left. And I noticed that while the discourse has gotten, I think, nastier, there's this huge amount of extremely right-wing, big media discourse that we didn't used to have. And it seems to me that the entire political spectrum has moved to the right. The discussion has moved to the right, and both parties have. And so I wonder what it is I'm missing about the Democratic Party supposedly moving to the left.
Well, I think when I made that comment, I was really talking about the Congress and what you've really seen. You know, there used to be a time in the Congress when there was a group known as moderate Republicans, and they were typically from the northeastern part of the country, but some from the Midwest. And then there were also what might be called the conservative or the blue dog Democrats. And if you look now at the most recent election, the Democrats who disproportionately lost were the moderate Democrats, the more conservative Democrats. And the moderate Republicans, there's a few left, but they really pretty much have disappeared. So various organizations would sort of rate members of Congress along some sort of conservative liberal dimension. It used to be the case that the most liberal Republican was actually more liberal than the most conservative Democrat. There was an overlap between the parties. That overlap is gone. So there's a greater chasm or gap between the two parties, and so that's part of what I was saying here. But I think the caller also makes the point. If you look at, let's say, the media environment, and you, for example, think about talk radio, you know, I mean, talk radio is overwhelmingly conservative. And that really is of, you know, relative in the last decade or so.
Just in terms of actual share of the market.
Yeah, and in terms of the content of programs or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, in fact, that does change the political discourse. There are plenty of people who might be further to the left who would say, oh, the Democratic Party is not a liberal party. It's too corporate in its orientation also. But the point I've made is that the gap between the Democrats and the Republicans is greater than it has been in the past.
You know, thank you very much, James, for that call. We have another caller. They left a message. To what extent has districting, congressional districting or redistricting, affected polarization of individuals? And I know that's a pet issue of yours.
Well, there are many people who believe both at the state level and the national level that when you have redistricting that is controlled by a political party, it's a partisan redistricting. Typically what they try to do, the party that controls the process, is it creates a number of districts for the minority party that are overwhelmingly safe for the minority party, and then a larger number of districts that are pretty much safe for the majority party. And so that really means that in the November election, these districts are not competitive. The really key battle is the primary. And so to win the Democratic primary, who votes in the Democratic primary? The liberal activists. So you move to the left in the Democratic primary. And in the Republican primary, you move to the right because that's where the Republican activists are. And if you have a system like that, then guess what? In the general election for these people, especially if the districts are reasonably safe, they don't have to move back to the center. And so you wind up electing Republicans who are more conservative than the average Republican and Democrats who are more liberal than the average Democrat. And guess what? You get, you know, very conservative people and very liberal people together, and they're polarized. Now, even when it's polarized, you would still hope that they could still have civil discourse, as Juan Williams was talking about. But a lot of us do believe that redistricting is part of the issue here. But also, you have so many other groups now who have gotten involved in politics. I think Juan Williams made the point that members of Congress, for example, are afraid in many instances to speak honestly about issues like Social Security or immigration. Well, one reason they're afraid it's going to cost them votes in an election.
Because it'll be used. That soundbite will be used.
That's right. But they're also afraid because of the interest groups associated with each political party. So if you remember at one point, President Bush and John McCain were talking about, in fact, a grand compromise on immigration. And it was, and Republicans were heavily involved in that. And now I think you're seeing Republicans not talking about that because there are some outside groups that, in fact, that say you have to be loyal to us on immigration and be very hostile to the whole immigration issue or whatever, or very tough on it, I should say. And so they're afraid to take it up. And there have been Democrats who have said, well, no, we know we need to do something about Social Security and Medicare, but they're terrified by these outside organizations that will, in fact, put pressure on them. So electoral considerations as well as interest group considerations, I think, help contribute to the fact that we're not addressing, for example, on the budget issues, the real key issues.
Jack from Clintonville, welcome to the show.
Hi there, Ann. Thanks for your program. Welcome. I've got a question for Mr. Williams. I'll ask the same question to Professor Asher. I just returned from a meeting sponsored by the Federalist Society at the University of Virginia, and one of the hallmarks was the fact that they invited speakers from, I think, a quite liberal perspective, and then we had conservative speakers, and then Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who arguably is the most conservative Supreme Court justice, gave a keynote talk. And my question is in Professor Asher, in your experience, do you find that groups like the Federalist Society are very numerous? I found very few. Do you have any comments about programs that groups like the Federalist Society puts on?
Yeah.
What can we do to further that kind of civil discussion?
Well, I think the more we have of it, the better. And actually in town here, not in the last couple of years, but I've spoken to the Federalist group here in Columbus. And in fact, I think that's a very good example of, in fact, bringing disparate sides together and having a conversation. And I think the more of that we do, whether it's sponsored by community groups, civic groups, or whatever, or whether it's universities that do that or special programs within universities, I think the more that we talk to each other, and perhaps do that out of the media limelight, because when in fact there is this direct media focus on it, oftentimes people feel the need to posture to demonstrate that they're really tough, they're going to represent their side. And I think what you're suggesting here, if we could sort of replicate that, and whether it's the Federalist Society doing that or the League of Women Voters doing that or any of a variety of community and civic groups, the more we do of that, the more we talk to each other, the more we get to know what motivates our fellow citizens and where they're coming from, I think the better off we'll be.
Thank you, Jack. Earlier in the program, we were talking about the National Institute for Civil Discourse that has been formed at the University of Arizona in Tucson in the wake of the shootings down there. As a committed product of academia, what's your impression of such a program?
Well, I think it's appropriate. And actually, at Ohio State University, President Gee has been talking about the importance of civil engagement and civil discourse.
Right.
And we've been having conversations with members of the General Assembly and members of the media community about how do we advance this? What role can universities play? And certainly, the Ohio State motto, education for citizenship, should certainly be civil discourse should be core to that. So I think universities can play a role, and you don't even need to have a special center to do that. It should really be embedded in the curriculum. That, in fact, that the notion of what we would expect of educated people in a democratic political system is to be informed, to care, to have perhaps some passion about things, and be able to engage in discourse in a respectful way, even if you sharply disagree with your opponents.
Are you comfortable that the concepts that are discussed and the issues that come up in something like the Institute really do trickle down to the average person, though?
Well, no, but partly because there's so many other things out there that work against that. I mean, all you have to do is go online to go, for example, to the Columbus Dispatch's website and wonderful news reporting, and then you get the comments from readers, and all of a sudden you're reading comments that are just offensive and obnoxious. Not suitable for the dinner table. In fact, I had actually made the reference, a suggestion. Maybe, in fact, newspapers should actually require that people who make comments identify who they are. Because I think, actually, one of the things that's happened in the country today between blogospheres, online stuff, is that people have anonymity. And when you're anonymous, you can get away with a hell of a lot.
That's all the time we have. Herb Asher, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be here.
That's Herb Asher. He's an OSU political science professor emeritus. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, oil prices and the economy. We'll look at the scenarios ahead as the Arab world roils. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock here on 89.7 NPR News. Former Senator Al Simpson tackled tough issues like immigration reform, veterans benefits, and the Federal Clean Air Act. Tonight on WOSU-TV, watch his rise to the second most powerful position in the Senate as Majority Whip. Nothing Else Matters, the story of Alan K. Simpson, is tonight at 10 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Edible Columbus, a magazine devoted to culinary traditions, seasonal cooking, and the local food movement in our community. More information on the spring edition coming March 1st can be found at ediblecolumbus.com.
This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media. 39 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today with temperatures falling to 34 degrees this afternoon. And good morning, it's 11 o'clock.
Thank you.
Ah, the soothing sounds of nature. Hear from local conservationists and a wildlife biologist about using native plants to create a mini refuge for wildlife, the birds, the bees, and the butterflies. Then the story behind human sex trafficking in central Ohio and who's doing what to stop it.
The lines do get really blurry because people are brainwashed and so addicted to drugs. But yes, the majority of sex workers that we meet are desperate to get out of the business.
That's Kay Danino, who is working to help women escape. We'll hear from WOSU's Mandy Trimble, who is reporting on this secretive and violent world. That's all coming up after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.